My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
He was a preacher who couldn't resist temptation.
The priest is accused of killing Sister Margaret Ann Paul in the chapel.
The strongest of cases against a powerful preacher in a town of true believers.
The legal age for marriage is at puberty. I'm not married to any teenage girls who don't want to be. I'm 74 years old.
I don't remember reading that in the Bible, sir.
You don't know anything about the Bible.
And he kept stabbing and smiling.
410 wounds, scars upon scars.
You're listening to Seven Deadly Sinners.
This is the final episode in the three-part series on the murdering minister, Matt Baker. Matt thought he was getting away with his crime, but he was no match for Carrie's family and friends, certain lawyers, PIs, and law enforcement who were all determined to expose Matt as the sexual deviant, master manipulator, and arrogant asshole who thought he could snuff out any life that inconvenienced him and get away with it.
There was a guy who was holding a Bible on Sunday telling everybody how to live, and he murdered his wife.
All right, let's get through the crappy stuff so we can finally get to Carrie's family's happy ending. You need it. I need it. We all need it. There were little birdies around Waco that would report back to Linda sightings of Matt. Besides the earlier phone call in the last episode, Linda got other calls from two other friends saying they'd seen Matt and Vanessa together. One at a fast food restaurant and another shopping for cell phones. Whether Matt knew people were reporting this back to Linda or not, he did have some evidence that Linda was on to him. When Linda had called AT&T and asked for phone records to be physically mailed to her, though she had already viewed them online, AT&T accidentally mailed them to Matt's house instead. As Matt may have been tipped off to Linda's suspicions, he ramped up his isolation and brainwashing of his two young daughters against their late mother and her parents, Linda and Jim. Matt began to explore the possibility of moving the girls to a different school district to get them further away from their maternal grandparents. This only fueled Linda's mission, however. Her next stop to uncover the truth was to visit Joanne Bristol's office and hear from her face to face just what was causing Carrie so much anxiety leading up to her death. Hearing that Carrie was fearful that Matt might be trying to kill her, Linda said, "Had I have known that, I would have grabbed her by the hair and pulled her out of that house and away from Matt Baker." Even though Linda couldn't save her while she was alive, she was determined to get justice for her daughter, and thus the Charlie's Angels were born. Emails and phone calls exchanging plans between Nancy, Kay, Lindsay, and Linda followed. Linda would divvy up tasks to each of them and would sign the emails to the Angels, Charlie. Linda also researched Unisom more and discovered that there were cases of children who took three times more of the drug than prescribed and didn't die. And when someone did die of an overdose, it appeared that the result was a slow death, which didn't fit Matt's story. How could she have OD'd on an over-the-counter sleep aid and two wine coolers in the 45 minutes that he claimed he was gone? Linda decided she needed to check on that story as well. So she instructed Nancy to go to the Hollywood Video Matt claimed he had been that night renting When a Man Loves a Woman for he and Carrie. Nancy asked for surveillance footage to determine if and when Matt was there. The assistant manager told her that she couldn't give out the footage to Nancy, but if the police requested it, they could come in and get the footage. Nancy asked her to keep them safe until she could get the cops to do that, and the manager agreed. Then the manager went a step further and reviewed the records and told Nancy that Matt had checked out the movie at 11:48 p.m. that night. It was another tragedy around this time, too, that would shine more of a light on the mishandling of Carrie's death. One of Kay's friend's sons committed suicide. Heartbreaking. But when Kay learned that they ordered an autopsy for the boy, it only further solidified that they should have done that with Carrie. So she called Billy Martin, the justice of the peace, who had originally made the decision to not order one. She said, "I just want to understand why there was no autopsy in my niece's death." Billy responded, "My understanding was that there was a handwritten suicide note." "No, it was typed," Kay said. "Even the signature." She then detailed the ominous words Carrie had spoken to Joanne Bristol. She said, "She's not saying they have proof that Matt killed Carrie, but we just want someone to look into it." "It definitely needs to be looked into," Martin said. "I'll call Hewitt PD today." 2 days later, they called Hewitt PD themselves to follow up. They got the runaround a bit and were told they needed to specifically speak to Sergeant Cooper. While they waited for a call back from Cooper, Lindsay did a little PI work on her own. She emailed Matt pretending to be understanding of him and asked if she could come by to look at Carrie's things. She wanted to have something that she could remember Carrie by, and Matt agreed. When Lindsay went over there, all the blinds were drawn in the house, and it was oddly dark despite it being a very sunny day out. Grace and Kenzie were there too, and they were really quiet that day. But after Lindsay said, "I'm just looking for something to remember Carrie by. I still miss her so much, and I want memories of her to help me move on." Matt then said, "Well, some people aren't able to move on, are they, Kenzie?" Kenzie didn't respond. Then Matt said, "Who isn't able to move on in this family?" Then Matt asked again. Kenzie, who always called her grandmother Grammy, finally said, "Linda can't move on." Matt's manipulation and gaslighting makes my skin crawl, but his brainwashing of his little girls would only get worse from there. Linda and Jim eventually got a call back from Sergeant Cooper and went down to the station to meet him. They told him they needed to do an autopsy and presented him with their findings so far. Cooper seemed irritated that his authority was being questioned, but Linda attempted to smooth things over, saying, "I'm not trying to tell you how to do your job. I just want you to have all the info that we have, and I've also asked Joanne Bristol to come to speak to you as well." Linda said again, "We need an autopsy." Cooper said that exhuming a body for an autopsy was something a judge had to decide on. Frustrated, but knowing she wasn't going to get much more out of Cooper that day, Linda and Jim left, and a few hours later, Bristol showed up. She met with Cooper and brought in 7 pages of handwritten notes about her session with Carrie and her concerns. Cooper listened and said if he needed more, he would give her a call. He never called. In the meantime, relations got worse between Linda and Matt. Linda, not one to meekly slip away and not speak her mind, received an email from Matt that the girls would not be coming to stay with Linda and Jim that Sunday while he conducted chapel, something they had done so often in the past. Linda responded asking for the information on Kenzie's talent show, so her and Jim could attend that at least. Matt didn't respond several times, then Linda said, "I will get the info. The choice is yours. You just need to be on notice that you will not keep Jim and me from our granddaughters, no matter how much you are trying to poison them against us." Matt Baker, the eternal victim, responded, "I'm asking for the final time. Stop. Stop accusing me. Stop blaming me. Stop cursing my name. Stop trying to make it appear that I don't care for my girls properly. Stop. Please stop before it causes a rift too deep. I've been praying for my family and you and Jim every day." Linda responded, "Enough of this. I will not be bullied by you. Do not threaten me in emails or anywhere else." Matt responded that Linda wasn't dealing with Carrie's death properly and said, "I can and will have to keep Kenzie and Grace at a distance from you. Stop blaming me. Love, Kenzie and Grace's father, Matt Baker." And with that, the girls were being systematically indoctrinated by Matt. Not long after, Linda happened by chance to run into Matt and the girls at Target. Grace ran to her, but Kenzie hung back. When Linda said, "I love you," she noticed that Kenzie looked up at her father meekly, almost with a look of, am I allowed to say I love you back? Then Matt just shuffled the girls away. Linda was never able to get the info on the talent show, and her and Jim missed it, but guess who was there? Vanessa No Shame Bowles, holding her infant and smiling proudly as if she was Kenzie and Grace's new mom and had taken Carrie's place, basking in the fact that Matt was so proud of his newer model girlfriend. I wonder if it ever crossed Vanessa's mind that she too could be replaceable. And how would Matt go about doing that? The teachers at the school whispered amongst themselves that it was just too weird to see them together, not even 2 months after Carrie died. After not hearing much from Cooper, Linda composed a letter to him, encouraged him to get the footage from Hollywood Video, to look into Matt's bank records, and to see if he really did get gas that night, and again insisted that an autopsy would answer a lot of questions. She also laid out the pills that Carrie found in Matt's briefcase, the crushed up ones that we will later find out in court Matt had planned to poison Carrie with in a milkshake he had lovingly asked her if she wanted him to make that night. She also told Cooper that Matt claims he reported the pills to the WCY, to the security, saying that some kids must have spit them in there. Unbeknownst to Linda and Jim, Cooper had already looked into this and had gone to the Waco Center for Youth, where he was able to verify that Matt had never made a report about the pills. For Jim, the anger was building inside him. He felt horrible that he wasn't able to protect his daughter. And as a military man, he was used to taking action. Sitting back and waiting for others to do something just wasn't in him. However, knowing all he and Linda could do was some of their own detective work, but they would have to just give that information to the cops, which they ultimately had to let them handle. But Jim found his own little way to be proactive. And in my opinion, it's pretty damn funny. Jim, looking for an outlet, went to a t-shirt shop at the mall and brought a photo of Carrie with Kenzie and Grace. And the following Sunday, when Matt stood at the crossroads pulpit, Linda and Jim sat right in the front row as he wore the t-shirt and his eyes intensely fixed on Matt, yet smiling at him. Afterward, Matt sarcastically said to Jim, "Oh, I like your shirt," to which Jim just smiled again. Matt was slacking more and more on his church duties too, preferring to spend his time with Vanessa. You know that calling the Lord had for him? The one he was so pulled by that he justified going back to the pulpit just days after both Cassidy and Carrie's death? As that's what God wanted him to do. I guess God changes his mind a lot in Matt's world. Linda, knowing that every day that went by that Carrie's body was not exhumed for an autopsy, evidence was being lost. So a friend suggested she call the Texas Rangers. And she was linked up with Matt Cawthon. Cawthon told Linda he wanted to help her, but she must go through the proper channels first. It was Ranger tradition not to overstep bounds right away. Give the other law enforcement a chance to do the right thing. He told Linda that if the detective and chief in charge won't help you at Hewitt PD, then you can write a letter to the DA asking them to approve the help of the Rangers. This, coupled with a small confrontation Linda wouldn't back down from at the Hewitt PD, Matt Baker was finally called in for questioning, 52 days after Carrie's death. Matt went down to the station with Kenzie and Grace in tow. "So healthy for your daughters, Matt. Wow, you're such a wonderful parent. Maybe leave them out of your bullshit. Don't use them as pawns." They sat in the waiting room while Matt went into the interrogation room with Cooper. Cooper began, "I want to talk to you about what happened that night so we can clear this all up, as far as Linda and Jim." Now, I don't know if that was a cop tactic to make Matt feel like he was on his side, or if Cooper really just thought Linda and Jim were being a pain in the ass. Matt and his new boy band goatee word vomited his rehearsed version of the events to Cooper, much of it unchanged from his original report on the scene. While most of the events seemed unchanged, he then started to add a few more activities during that time that he was gone. He said that the first corner store he went to near the house had already shut down for the night, as Hewitt closes around 11 p.m., Matt said. From there, Matt said he stopped at a second gas station that wouldn't take cards with the pump, and so he went inside and he found out that they only sold diesel. Then he eventually filled up at an Exxon. He said that he then drove north to the Hollywood Video, where he rented the movie, bought Diet Pepsi and peanut M&Ms. Cooper asked, "How long do you think you were at the Hollywood Video?" Matt said 10 minutes. When he returned home, he said he found the bedroom door locked and thought maybe Carrie was trying to just be romantic. But when he opened the door with a screwdriver... "Wait, Matt, so you went from, oh, fun romantic, to screwdriver that quickly? Did you call her name? Anything? Also, I'd love to know if there were any markings on that lock showing that it was jimmied into." He said when he got inside, he said that Carrie was pale, her lips blue, and she wasn't moving. He thought, "That's not good." "Hey, Matt, That's more than not good. That's heartbreaking, tragic, traumatizing. Use your words, Matt. He then recounted pulling her lifeless body off the bed, her urinating and vomiting, though the scene was completely dry when everyone else arrived. Cooper didn't inquire more about the water or lack thereof at the scene. Then he asked Matt if there was a note. Matt's response, it's a whirlwind. I know there was a note. I know it said, I'm sorry, and tell my parents I love them. But Matt kept trying to just focus on what would make Carrie kill herself. One of his theories being that even though she seemed excited about the new job prospect, he wondered if she was dreading changing classes, changing grades again. Then Matt began to insult and disgrace every part of Carrie's life and used his daughters by putting words in their mouth to describe Carrie's nature, as he calls it. He said, "My oldest daughter said recently that Carrie would blow up over nothing. It could be that there wasn't a cold Diet Pepsi in the refrigerator and it's a heated battle." And like the victim he always claims to be, he shrugged, "I love Carrie, don't get me wrong, but that's just who she was." Then Matt claimed 2 weeks prior, Kenzie had swim practice and he had offered to take her. And Carrie said to him, "Well, maybe you'd be all better off if I wasn't here." He claims she didn't want to be labeled as depressed, that only sickos were labeled as depressed. Then described her trying to jump out of the car on the freeway. All things he had been trying to force down everyone's throat in the weeks leading up to Carrie's death. Then, as if Matt knew Linda had questioned how Carrie could die so quickly from an OD on sleeping pills, or maybe because his search history would prove his own research later, he said, as if confiding in Cooper like a buddy, "This is my thing. I don't think the medicine is what killed Carrie. I think she threw open her mouth and it choked her." Cooper didn't comment, but asked more about the night he found her. Why was she naked? Matt's theory, kind of like how she wanted to jump out of the car, that she took her clothes off because she felt trapped. Then he got caught in a lie. Cooper asked him about the pills Carrie found in his briefcase. And instead of regurgitating the story he had in the past, he now claimed he'd never seen the pills in his briefcase. And in his opinion, what probably happened is that the pills were Carrie's. Matt said, "I told Carrie to have them tested." Cooper, "You told her that?" Matt, "Yeah, but she insisted and she wanted to wash them down the sink." Cooper, "Did you tell her that someone else put them in there, one of the kids?" Matt, "One of my things I said, that if it is from work, that's what it would be. I know there are kids who hide things. If you want me to, I'll talk to security. But she said, no. And that's when she washed them down the sink." Cooper, "Did you tell anyone at work about them?" Matt said, "No, I truly didn't believe it was from the kids." He then asked him about Vanessa, to which he denied any affair, and that the only reason he'd called the Bowles house is to ask what it was like having Vanessa and Lily live there, since he was considering moving in with the Doolins. Matt then spun a story about Linda grabbing Kenzie by the arm and pulling her into a bedroom on Mother's Day, traumatizing Kenzie, and insinuating that Linda was somehow abusive. "No, Matt, I think you're getting your mixed up with your parents. Oh, maybe because they didn't abuse you, you were able to turn a blind eye. Never mind, we'll get to that." We will hear of the horrific abuse his foster siblings endured at the hands of his parents at the end of this. Then he said that Linda is a very controlling person and that Kenzie doesn't want to go back to her grandparents' house. She said it's a dark, sad house. And Grace said recently that there's no happiness in that house, Matt claims. I'm sorry, Matt, but 5-year-olds don't speak like that. Then Cooper asked the big question. Do you think your mother and father-in-law think that you played a part in Carrie's death? I don't know. They never said that to me, but I'd be very hurt if they thought that. Personally, that would destroy any relationship I have with them. Then Cooper said, do you think at any time Carrie thought you might be trying to hurt her? Matt, I don't know. For a while, she was paranoid. Cooper, it's a question I had to ask. Matt, she never said to me that she thought I was trying to kill her. The only person she would have said that to was Joanne Bristol, and the only thing Carrie accused me of was trying to do something with those pills. Matt then said that Carrie had a history of accusing him of being unfaithful and was always paranoid, even when he just casually mentioned a woman. He said, with 2 jobs, I had no time for anything other than work. Then Cooper said, I just wanted to sit down and talk to you about what happened that night. One last thing that would really put the icing on the cake. Quell everything. If I asked you to, would you take a polygraph test? Matt nodded yes. Cooper, would you have a problem with that? Matt mumbled no, shaking his head. Then, are you thinking I did have something to do with it? I'm just looking at everything, Cooper said. The Doolins are asking questions, so I want to clear it up. Are they accusing me of anything, Matt said. No, no one is accusing you of anything. They're not doing anything. I'm just looking things up for myself. So will you take the polygraph? Without hesitation, Matt said, absolutely. And with that, he released Matt. Linda and Jim still felt they couldn't rely on the Hewitt PD, so Linda asked her husband, is it okay if I take the lead? Sure, Jim said, of course. It was as if he had given her a gift, the go-ahead to look into her daughter's death and do one last thing for Carrie. The day after Cooper's interview with Matt, Linda went to the Hewitt PD and requested anything that was public on the case. She was given the cover sheet in the police report. The only information on it to help with the exact time of the 911 call was 12:03 a.m. Then she asked Nancy to once again go to the Hollywood Video and verify that his checkout time was at 11:48. At her desk at home, Linda pieced together the events on a timeline. She then made more phone calls, including to the EMT, to determine what time the first responders arrived on the scene. With every fact, Linda nailed down another piece of the puzzle in what happened that night Carrie died. People of the church began to buzz, too. Did Carrie really commit suicide? And what's up with Matt and Vanessa Bowles? Matt even began canceling Sunday evening services to be with Vanessa, and the deacons of the church gave him a $1,600 severance pay and said he was no longer needed at Crossroads. While all this was happening, and who knows how the hell he was going to pay for it, Matt was looking up honeymoon trips for he and Vanessa to Fiji. Linda and Jim then hired an attorney to sue Matt for visitation of the grandchildren. Linda was then also referred to Bill Johnston by a friend. Bill, a former federal prosecutor, sat down with Linda and said, let's get started. He invited two other men to the meeting, John Bennett and Mike McNamara, both private investigators after long careers in law enforcement. Linda explained that she wasn't just trying to pin it on Matt. She just felt like there were many inconsistencies, and she just wants to know what happened to her daughter. Johnston then explained to Linda that before she hired him, they needed to let McNamara and Bennett do some sleuthing first. Barbara Baker, Matt's mom, however, was busying herself making sure that Matt Baker would always be a little prince attached to mommy. She traveled to Waco often and said she didn't like his relationship with Vanessa. Barbara would say, I could see that woman was attached to my son, her hands all over him, physical touch. Yet, Barbara claimed nothing happened between the two, saying that Matt was home alone in his bed early every night. Matt, obviously not caring about his mom's meddling for once, solidified his relationship with Vanessa by asking her father if they could officially date, to which Vanessa's dad said, that's Vanessa's decision. And then off they went in the new truck Matt had just purchased. Where is this money coming from? They were also looking at buying new houses, some that were more than $200,000, a considerable jump from what he had been living in with Carrie. But Matt's pretty little life with Vanessa was about to get complicated when Sergeant Cooper walked into the Waco Center for Youth while Matt was working and said he'd like to set up a polygraph. Matt was nervous but said he'd call him. But it was Matt's criminal defense attorney who would later call Sergeant Cooper and said Matt would not be talking to him anymore and he had advised him not to take a polygraph. Within days, the Texas Ranger Linda had contacted was having lunch with the two private investigators working for Linda and also a detective from the Waco PD. They sat and discussed the Baker case. After they parted ways, the detective called Bennett with an idea. You should do a public information request on Baker with the Waco PD. They had already done it. They had thought they wouldn't find anything with, you know, Matt being a preacher and all, but boy, were they wrong. The paperwork contained notes on his attempted sexual assault at Baylor, among other reports from teens at former jobs. And then came perhaps the most incriminating of all Matt Baker's behavior after Carrie's death. When Matt went into the Waco Center for Youth on his day off, a national holiday, he encountered Christina Salazar, who was only working to cover the switchboard on that day. Matt began to ask Christina some questions, one being about the insurance he had on Carrie through his job. Salazar said that she doubted he could get paid on it because her death was ruled a suicide. She told him to call HR, but even then she wasn't sure if Matt had been working there long enough. Matt looked disappointed, so Salazar said to him, "I'm really sorry about your loss." "Matt, our relationship ended a long time ago. I wasn't Carrie's husband, more her counselor and her friend." "Awkward," then Salazar said, "Well, how are the girls doing? They must miss Carrie so much. She did so much for them." Matt said, "I've really been the one taking care of the girls, not Carrie. She was so depressed, she never really did anything with them." He said Carrie was like a black cloud around the house. The girls always felt like they had to tiptoe around her. Then Matt, seemingly going off the rails, while Salazar listened in disbelief, said, "I'm giving the girls more freedom, and I'm allowing Kenzie to use the F word. Then he showed Salazar a photo of Vanessa and said, "We're into each other. The girls want a new mommy." He then pointed to a photo of Lily, Vanessa's daughter, and said, "Doesn't she look like me? She looks like she could be mine." He confided in Salazar that Vanessa had a year left at college and then they would be married. Unprompted by Salazar, Matt then launched into an account of the night Carrie died. Contradicting himself from prior accounts to others and to police, Matt no longer claimed Carrie was awake when he left the house. He said, "She had a hard time holding her eyes open." He also said that the police found the note, not him, and that he had recently been called back in to talk to the police. Then Salazar, being one of the unsung heroes of this story, said to Matt, "You could tell when the note was typed, you know. If it was written on a computer, there's a time on it. If it was, well, you were gone, that should answer any questions." Matt, "Oh, I got rid of our home computer. Maybe Carrie wrote it at work." "Well, then you can subpoena her computer from work and your computer from your work." Then Matt excused himself and left. Later that afternoon, a security guard noticed Matt carrying a box through the parking lot toward his truck. It turns out Salazar was right about many things, including the fact that Carrie's insurance would not be paying Matt on Carrie's death. But her retirement fund did, however, come in a few weeks later, and he pocketed $51,644.80. He also filed for Social Security survivor's benefits, including stipends for Kenzie and Grace. Barbara, loving to meddle in her son's life, emailed him a few days later, saying that there was a job opening for a hospital chaplain. Then basically said that she didn't think he should bring Vanessa and Lily. It might make people question the quick relationship and marriage. If he and the girls came for a little while and then Vanessa joins later, that might make it more acceptable. Saying, "If you and the girls stay with us, I think it will make it look more innocent. Do you understand what I'm trying to say?" I mean, Barbie had a point. I know her name isn't Barbie, but I just like saying it. PI Mike McNamara began questioning Carrie's friends and colleagues, too. He spoke with one of the teachers at Carrie's school, and she told McNamara that a week after Carrie's death, she ran into Matt and the girls at a Walmart. Matt began awkwardly describing to her about finding Carrie's body that night, and then, in a bizarre move, tried to create an air of suspicion about Carrie. He said that when the cops asked him if his girls were all right, he went to their bedrooms to check and thought, "If Carrie did anything to the girls, I would go get her out of the ambulance." A threat? The problem was that the police, EMTs, no one saw Matt enter his daughter's room that night. As they said their goodbyes, the teacher took note of what was in his cart. A new computer, printer, and monitor. The PI immediately felt he was onto something. Why would Matt Baker want to replace his home computer a week after his wife's death? Between that discovery and what we now know from his interaction with Salazar, the next few days would become even more shady surrounding Matt Baker and computers. 3 days later, at WCY, when the chaplain's assistant went into Terry Corbin's empty office, one of Matt's colleagues he routinely fought with, to use her computer, only to find her computer tower was missing. He immediately reported this to Matt, his boss, and the two men looked more closely around Terry's office. When nothing was found, Matt said, "I'll report it." 5 days later, Matt reported the missing computer to security, and the WCY's tech expert was notified. The tech expert went onto the network to see when the last time that computer had been used. When was the last time it had been connected to the network? What he discovered was that it was still being used, and determined that the one using Terry's computer was Matt Baker. When the tech went into Matt's office and inspected the computer, he saw that it had a WCY sticker on it, identifying it as Matt's, but then when he checked the serial number, it was actually the one from Terry's office. Someone had clearly switched the computers, so then where was Matt Baker's computer? When the tech asked Matt where Matt's computer was, he said he didn't know. Then Matt wrote a report that said, "I do not remember the exact date that I found my computer turned out at a different angle, but it would be approximately 2 weeks ago, around the time the tower might have been exchanged." He then said, although his office was locked, he suggested that the volunteers who came on the campus had access to the offices and would have been able to make the switch. The tech began to notice some other weird things. They searched the entire campus for Matt's computer, but it was never found. And then the tech remembered that Matt had asked him if deleted emails could be retrieved off a computer. They could. The tech then looked into it more and discovered that Matt's computer was disconnected from the network at 11:37 a.m. the morning of June 19th, the holiday that Matt went in and had that conversation with Salazar, where she told him about computer tracking. Well, I'm sure you can all guess what Matt was carrying out to his car that day in a box. The cards are beginning to crumble around Matt Baker. With that, the WCY security notified the police of this, and they opened a case file on the missing computer. As rumors continued to float around Waco and Crossroads Church, the people started to not believe Kerry committed suicide, especially after the circus Matt and Vanessa put on right after Kerry's death. This all must have gotten back to Steve Sadler, the pastor who presided over Kerry's funeral, the pastor that was allowed access to her Bible journal, the pastor that had made a photocopy of something Kerry wrote that made him uneasy. Now, putting two and two together, Sadler went down to the police station and gave them the photocopy where Kerry wrote in her own words, "Lord, I'm asking you to protect me from harm. I'm not sure what is going on with Matt, but Lord, help me to find peace with him." Everything was falling into place. On July 6th, it was decided that they would exhume Kerry's body for autopsy. They also decided to remove Cooper as lead investigator on the case, and then 28-year-old Toombs was assigned to the case. A dark-haired young man who initially protested taking on the case as he had connections to it. His father was a deacon at Crossroads, and he had met Matt, and he also briefly lived near Vanessa Bull's family and thought of her as a nice young girl. And from what he knew, he did not think Matt Baker was guilty. His mother even spoke well of the former pastor, and the young officer even thought Matt, you know, he had an affair with Vanessa, sure, but that didn't make him a killer. But even with his protesting, the case was his. Assigned to help Toombs was Mike Spear, a baby-faced detective. The first task was to find out about the procedure for exhuming a body. On July 10th, the judge signed the order for her body to be exhumed from Oakwood Cemetery, Section 1, Lot 96, Space 2. The two detectives proceeded to the cemetery where a backhoe was waiting. Kerry's slightly dented casket was lifted out of the ground, and before long, a pathologist arrived. The casket was opened. Dressed in a teal sweater and skirt set, Kerry's body was transferred onto an exam table. Kerry's organs were each removed and weighed. Yet, when it came to take samples for toxicology, there was a problem. The tests were usually done on blood, but instead, all the blood had been drained and replaced with embalming fluid. So, they had to check her muscle tissue instead. They sent that to the lab. While they waited, Detective Toombs called Matt's attorney to inform him of what was transpiring. Matt rushed to the cemetery with his mother. At Kerry's place of rest, he stood above the empty grave, his phone to his ear, talking to Vanessa Bowles. And then, in an incredibly eerie statement, came out of Matt's mouth. For his thoughts were not only on Kerry that day. He said to Vanessa, "I wonder if they dug up Cassidy's too." Moments later, he quickly walked the short distance to the child's grave, the one marked, "My sweet, sweet baby." Matt sighed a huge breath of relief and said to Vanessa, "No, she's still there." Why would Matt think they would exhume Cassidy as well? Guilty much? When it was time to rebury Carrie's body, they did so in a new casket that was pristine. And one lone man waited at the cemetery. It was Jim Doolin. The detectives arrived, but before they left, Jim said to them, "I just want to tell you, you get him or I will," he said, crying. "If I get him, y'all be coming after me." When the autopsy report came back, the toxicologist found traces of phentermine, the diet drug she was taking, Unisom, and something else. Something she didn't have a prescription for. Ambien. After the complete autopsy was performed, the combined effects of phentermine, Unisom, and Ambien in conjunction with the possible use of alcohol may have contributed to the cause of death. However, accurate blood concentrations of these drugs cannot be determined due to embalming. If additional information becomes available, the manner of death may be amended, it said. They also wanted to cross-reference this autopsy, though, with a highly regarded forensic toxicologist, Dr. David Stafford. After reviewing, Dr. Stafford said, "This woman did not die of an overdose." He then went on to explain the chemistry of death by overdose. If Carrie had taken that bottle of pills, the pills would break down at individual rates and absorbed at different times. As they took effect, her system would have slowed. At death, some of the pills would have remained undigested in her stomach, but there were none in Carrie's stomach or intestines. "That means she didn't die of an overdose," Stafford said. "It's not possible." Then the detective asked, "Could she have aspirated and choked?" "No," Stafford said. "Her lungs were clear." The next task for the detectives was retracing Matt Baker's movements that night based on the video from his police interview. They determined that Matt Baker should have been home 10 minutes before he said he was, or at least 10 minutes before he made the 911 call. They also gathered as much information as possible from the reports made by the girls and women Matt had sexually assaulted. They even got a hold of Laura Wilson Mueller. After struggling a bit to track her down now that she was married and had a different last name, detectives left her a message, and that following morning, July 22nd, Laura called back and said, "I can't speak to what happened to Carrie Baker, but I can tell you what Matt Baker did to me. I left Baylor feeling as if they turned their backs on me and supported Matt. They treated me like I was some screwed up slut who wanted to ruin the life of a good ministry student." Before she ended the call, she begged, "Please get him before he does it again." The detectives also wanted to follow up with the Bowles family, so they drove up to Vanessa's house and they spoke to Vanessa's father, Larry. Under questioning, Larry Bowles confirmed Matt had begun calling Vanessa months before Carrie's death. Then, based on what they now knew from the autopsy, they asked an important question. "Does anyone in the household have a prescription for Ambien?" Larry said that his wife Cheryl did, and then they asked if Vanessa could have given Matt the Ambien. Larry responded, "I don't know." They then went down to WCY and spoke with the tech expert there. They told him to secure any data off the main network from Matt's old computer and they'd be back with a subpoena. They called Linda to update her on the steps they had been taking. So she went and met with Johnson, her attorney, and the detectives. When Johnson wondered out loud if Matt might have killed Cassidy too, the possibility terrified Linda. She said, "I began to wonder if Kenzie or Grace could become inconvenient for Matt. What if they are in danger as well?" A horrifying thought. Continuing with the interviews, they also spoke to the woman who worked at Kay Jewelers, and she told them everything. With that info, they knew they needed to speak with Vanessa. They began calling her, and she ignored them. They said they'd meet her at her work to talk, but she'd say she was leaving and didn't want to talk to them. They then told her exactly what they thought of her. Well, specifically our Texas Ranger Cawthon. He would later say, "I know I wasn't going to catch a fly with honey with her. I told her, I'll be coming after you." Rumors began circling that Vanessa and Matt had broken up. Her parents had asked her not to see him anymore, or at least until Carrie's death investigation was over. The detectives were at this time able to finally corner Vanessa as she was leaving class. She looked stunned to see them, but eventually agreed to go down to the station and speak with them. At the station, they led her into the interrogation room, gave her a seat, and then exited the room for a few minutes while the camera rolled. Vanessa looking less glamorous and much more average, hair in a ponytail with athletic shorts on and a John Deere t-shirt. She fidgeted and then yawned. Once the detective returned, he read her her Miranda warning. Then he began to ask her basic questions, date of birth, etc., to which Vanessa grabbed a tissue and said this.
Like I said, you're not under arrest and this doesn't mean that you're under arrest. Okay?
I'm sorry, this is just scary.
I know.
Then she denied having any affair with Matt. She positioned it like it was more her and Carrie that were friendly. She said Carrie would often talk to her about her divorce and her daughter Lily. She said Carrie was the one who would reach out to her saying, I have a daughter and their daughters loved mine, and Carrie and I talked about getting together for dinner and get the kids out and eat or something. She admitted that Matt had begun calling her house in February 2006, 2 months before Carrie's death, but said he called asking for her father, who wasn't there at the time, then said he didn't know I'd be home. She said from that point, Matt's calls went from a few times a week to 2 to 3 times a day. She said she just figured he was doing the pastor thing and wanted to counsel her about her divorce. In the interrogation, she also said that it didn't seem like he was pursuing her and that he seemed happily married and he never talked bad about his wife. She then explained how innocently her and Matt began hanging out after Carrie's death, saying the first time was that Good Friday dinner with her and her parents. She even elaborated, saying that he wasn't really her type. He was shorter than she was. She then said she had no idea what Matt's intentions were with her until about a month after Carrie's death, when her father told her that Matt had come to ask if he could date Vanessa. She also insinuated that their dates were always chaperoned by their children. They were never one-on-one.
After his wife passed away.
Okay.
Because I didn't think there was anything wrong.
Okay.
Then she said that her parents began telling her of the rumors about Matt. She at first didn't believe them, and then, when they asked her to stop seeing him, she kind of started to listen. She initially refused, like I said, but then realized for herself that Matt hadn't been honest about everything, and her parents told her some stuff about his past, and Vanessa said, it made me want to throw up. She then claimed she broke it off with Matt, and he was angry, but didn't, like, rage violent or anything. She then says how she feels about the breakup. She said, I've been fine since. I haven't lost any sleep. After interviewing her, they were still not getting the whole story, and they knew it.
Why don't y'all then talk to Matt Baker, you know?
She then faked horror when they asked her if she thought it was possible that Matt killed Carrie to be with her. Well, that didn't cross my mind until a couple weeks ago. I was like, that can't be. I've seen too many Lifetime movies. Then, instead of hurting for Carrie, she got sassy and defensive, as if the suggestion that she would ever be with Matt was a personal insult. She said, quote, if he did that, if he thought I just got divorced and he was just going to slide me into their lives, that's wrong. She denied knowing anything about the night Carrie died, the crushed up pills Carrie found in his briefcase. They asked her if she thought he had anything to do with Carrie's death, and she said, after knowing he lied, it's possible. They then asked her, was there anything else she found suspicious? She explained the inconsistencies with Cassidy's death that made her worry that Matt may have done something to Cassidy. They ended the interview, and I believe Vanessa thought she fooled them. After all, they did seem to be on her side when they said their goodbyes, saying, it's not your fault, Matt Baker is a dirtbag. But I believe they were just trying to get on her good side. In August, detectives returned to WCY with a subpoena for everything on Matt's missing computer. They gathered the CDs with the info from the computer's network. And what they saw sent a chill up their spines. Internet searches on drug sites. They then got a computer specialist to help, and armed with the disks and the Dell laptop they obtained from his old job at Crossroads, here's what they found. While working at the church, he was visiting dating and porn websites like private.cams.com and coolanalsite.com, intermixed with Matt searching for internet sermons he could rip off from other preachers. Then came more. Widewomen.com, sexlist.com, hotmatchup.com, sextracker.com, sexdatenetwork.com, bustydustystash.com, iwantanewgirlfriend.com, and hornymatches.com. And then a longer list of drug sites came up, including drugs.com, medicinenet.com, rxlist.com, hydrocodone.com, drugslist.com, firstmeds.com, and even ambien.com. And then when they saw secure.rxcart.com on March 23rd, 2 weeks before Carrie's death, they really knew they had something. That account was accessed by Matt Baker. It was a Canadian-based online pharmacy, and he had placed an order in his shopping cart. Before long, they contacted the owner of that website, Mark Henry. Not only had Matt Baker, the idiot, accessed the site from his WCY computer, he also accessed it with the screen name MattDB7722. And what was in that shopping cart was generic Ambien. However, the owner of the site said the purchase was never completed, which wasn't unusual because many potential buyers backed out at that juncture because after they'd had the drugs in their cart, they learned that it was a 2-week delay before the drugs could be delivered. The computer expert then delivered more CDs of info from his WCY computer after he was able to pull more data off the network. These showed that he had accessed sites selling hydrocodone and the date rape drug GHB. Additionally, he had Googled the phrase overdose on sleeping pills. He also had purchased over-the-counter sexual stimulants on his computer, the pills that he had got special for Carrie, which we will find out he had emptied the contents and put Ambien in instead. This was the closest thing they had to a smoking gun. They also got word from the Justice of the Peace, Billy Martin, that her death had been moved from suicide to undetermined. And now the abrasion on Carrie's nose made it appear that she was first drugged and then smothered to death. Still, nothing was concrete, but no one was giving up. Even though the DA's office was dragging their heels, they still could put pressure on the Hewitt PD to arrest him. The Texas Rangers assisting in the case went down to Hewitt PD and told the chief, "If you don't write a warrant for Baker, the Rangers would." The chief was upset. He kept asking, "Why are you pushing this case? Who are you working for?" The Ranger said, "I'm working for that dead girl, and you should be too." It worked. The chief instructed the detectives on the case to write that warrant. Matt had somehow gotten word that they were out to arrest him, and before they got to his school where he was a substitute teacher at, he fled. They searched around town until hours later, Matt turned himself in. Matt Baker was finally in police custody. Matt was in jail for 1 month on a $200,000 bond. During that time, Barbara was raising money from the people of his hometown who believed in him. He eventually made bail and returned to his hometown. Not only did the community rally around him, but an experienced former prosecutor had gone into private practice and found out about the former preacher who was being falsely accused and offered to represent him pro bono. The man was Guy James Gray, and this would be a decision he would later go on to regret. But before he officially took Matt on, he wanted to make sure that Matt was telling the truth about everything, including that he hadn't had an affair with Vanessa. So Gray personally called Vanessa himself, and she assured him that there had been no physical contact with Matt while Carrie was alive, and that she knew nothing about the way Carrie died. With that, Gray figured Matt didn't have a motive, so he trusted him and was officially set to defend him. After more legal back and forth, the court, being sure Matt was guilty, but worried the jury wouldn't be able to convict Matt without a reasonable doubt, things again stalled. Meanwhile, Matt and his mother Barbara were doing everything in their power to keep Kenzie and Grace away from Linda and Jim, telling them that they are trying to take their daddy away from them. Matt was also on what seemed like a media tour. He spoke with any reporter that asked, and he would quote Bible verses on camera and defend his innocence. He pretended to be a grieving husband, devastated over the loss of his wife. He also went further and prayed for God's forgiveness in his in-laws for their unfair persecution. But so many people were on Carrie's side. The public rallied around her, and one former friend even made a bumper sticker that said, "Justice for Carrie." This outcry from the public forced the DA's office to step it up. In January 2009, they began to reinvestigate, and they started with speaking to Vanessa Bowles again. They knew she knew more than she had said. Vanessa tried to play naive and like a victim of Matt's manipulation. She was just an innocent divorcee after all. The DA's office wasn't having it, though. They threatened her, saying that if she didn't tell the truth, she could be charged with an accessory to murder. They said she could get out of this, however, though, if she agreed to speak before the grand jury and testify against Matt. And with that, she sang like a bird in order to get that immunity. And finally, the morning of March 25th, 2009, the death of Carrie Baker was set to go before the grand jury. The prosecution's star witness, Vanessa Bowles, was set to tell all. Before the grand jury, she was asked, "Did Matt Baker ever tell you anything about his wife's death?" Quote, "He told me that he killed her to be with me," Vanessa said. And with that, the grand jury returned an indictment on the charge of murder against Matthew D. Baker. At this point, Guy James Gray attempted to pull out of the trial as Matt had lied to him about the affair. Guy James Gray now felt the same way the prosecutors did. Matt Baker was a liar. Gray petitioned the judge to be let off the case, but the judge refused. And with that, Gray later said, "From that point on, I never talked to Baker unless I legally had to. I wanted nothing to do with him." On January 13th, 2010, the case went to trial, and along with the evidence found on Matt's computer, the autopsy findings, they also presented their star witness, Vanessa Bowles. Carrie's family was there every day of the trial, hearing the heartbreaking details of how terribly Matt had treated Carrie. When the attorney questioning Vanessa said, "How do we know to believe you, Vanessa?" She replied, "Because what do I have to gain from this right now?" As she continued, she glared in anger as she looked across the room. "I could possibly lose my job as a teacher. Everyone is looking at me really bad right now. I'm setting things right." She actually came across arrogant at many times.
"Would you please state your name for the record?"
"Yes, it's Vanessa Bowles." His wife was so depressed. He said she was a horrible mother, a horrible wife. They didn't have sex anymore.
Vanessa even gave an anecdote that made her look alarmingly bad. Vanessa said that he mentioned that he would leave a note, and he said that he would type it. And I said, shaking her head, "That's never going to work. You're going to be caught." And he said, "Oh no, she types everything." That's bone chilling. How much more advice or insight did Vanessa offer him to get the job done? The final week before he killed Carrie, he told Vanessa he had attempted to buy roofies to render Carrie helpless. He also said to Vanessa that in an attempt to make Carrie think he was working on their marriage, he did the husbandly duty of having sex with Carrie. When Vanessa heard from her mom that Carrie was dead, she said she was stunned, or at least pretended to be. Then 2 days later, when she was with Matt, he apparently told her, "You know you're stuck with me now, right?" Then he told her how he committed the murder, and he cautioned her that if she told anyone, it would be to no avail because he was a preacher.
He said, "I'm going to tell you what happened that night, one time." Then he said, "I never want to talk about it again."
He explained the murder like this to Vanessa. All the while, Jim and Linda cried quietly and held each other. The horrifying story went like this. Matt had poured Ambien into the shells from the sex stimulant capsules and then fed them to Carrie with the wine coolers.
He said he handcuffed her to the bed, started kissing her and touching her all over until she fell asleep. He said he kissed her on the forehead and either said, "Give Cassidy a hug for me," or "Give Cassidy a kiss for me." Then he said he got the pillow and put it over her face.
Then he heard Carrie gasp for air. She wasn't dead.
He said, "Oh, shit." And then he said he put the pillow on her face, but then he said he did this with his hand where her nose was, so he would be sure to suffocate her.
The most heartbreaking thought is that Vanessa Bowles could have stopped him, but took no action to do so. She even knew the day he had intended to murder his wife.
He talked about maybe putting something in a milkshake, making it look like she'd hung herself, maybe doing a drive-by shooting, make it look like she overdosed on sleeping pills, tampering with the brakes of her car.
The prosecutor then asked Vanessa, "Had it not occurred to you that if he killed one wife, he might kill another?" Vanessa says, "I thought he would, but he promised me that he would be so happy that he would never do that." She is truly very cocky. Then, despite basically admitting that she had acted as Matt's confidant in his cold-blooded plan to murder his wife, she was asked if she was worried that she'd be charged with a crime. And she said, "Absolutely not, because I didn't do anything wrong." On January 21st, after a week-long trial, the jury gathered back into the courtroom and said, "We find the defendant guilty." They sentenced him to 65 years in prison. At his sentencing, Linda finally got to say this to him. Clips.
"I'm talking to you, Matt, today, okay? You haven't looked at me in almost 4 years. Can you look at me today? For a little while, okay? And Matt, she loved you. But more than anything, she loved her girls. Her love for Kinsey, Cassidy, and Grace was engraved on her soul. On her soul. And then you took her from us, Matt. You discarded her like she was yesterday's trash. And you left so many other victims. The people in your churches who want to believe that the person leading them truly is a man of God. Your family, your family, Matt, your friends, the people who believed in you, you really can't look at me, can you? Then we have to step out and forgive. So we do. We forgive. Because that's the only way, Matt. The only way that love makes the way. So that eventually, just as in this case, love trumps evil."
Matt's reaction was gross, as per usual. He wouldn't look up and show Linda Doolin the respect she deserved. At a sentencing, he said he believed the jury made a mistake, and he believed in his innocence. Matt attempted to file appeals, but none took. He also, in true Matt Baker fashion, soon after entering prison, was punished for making obscene sexual hand gestures at a female worker. Yet this scumbag and his family would still try to exert control from his prison cell through his mother. They had brainwashed Kenzie and Grace so much that they were refusing to ever see Linda and Jim again. Linda and Jim were so worried what life would be like with them being manipulated into thinking that their dad was innocent and getting out of jail soon. It would give them false hope. They didn't want to force it on them to think that their dad was a murderer, but the idea that they were constantly being fed the false hope that their father would be out of prison and that their maternal grandparents were to blame for him being there was unhealthy for their psyche. Even more horrifying, though, is that Linda and Jim were worried for the girls' safety, living at Barbara and Oscar Baker's house. Family secrets had begun to come out during Matt Baker's investigation and trial. Secrets about to be revealed at the custody hearing for Kenzie and Grace. At the custody hearing, multiple former foster children of Barbara and Oscar came forward and alleged emotional, physical, and sexual abuse. While many of them went on the stand to testify against Barbara and Oscar, I think I only need to tell you one of their stories for you to get the full picture. While Oscar Baker sat at the witness table in his 80s, balding with his bulky body slouched, a middle-aged woman took the stand named Tracy Owens. She was thin with dark hair, a former foster child of the Bakers. And when she spoke, she stared straight ahead. She began to describe her time in foster care to the horrified courtroom. She was in their care beginning at the age of 7 years old. She said that Oscar began touching her while he bathed her. Then he progressed to touching her in bed through sheets and pajamas. Before long, she said the petting had progressed to Oscar instructing her to perform oral sex on him. Then full sexual intercourse when she was just 8 years old. She said that in the 2 years she lived with the Bakers, that Oscar had even passed her around to other men within the community, including a popular Kerrville Baptist minister. When the court asked her why she didn't report it, she said that the Bakers threatened her. "I was told God was watching me. I was told not to tell anyone. I was told that if I did, I wouldn't get to go home to my mom. She wouldn't want me or my brother." When asked if the Bakers should be allowed to parent any children, the woman uttered, "No, sir." After she left the stand and they took a break, her eyes met the other former foster children that had been there to testify, and they all began to cry and hug each other. When the court was back in session and the jurors entered the courtroom one last time, they gave their decision. As the psychologist that testified had recommended, both girls would be moving to Waco and would live with Linda and Jim Doolin. This long, painful journey was finally coming to an end. Though it would take years and counseling, the girls started doing wonderfully, and they also began to realize that Linda and Jim were not the enemy. Now, 10 years later, I Googled Kenzie and Grace, and they grew into beautiful young women. It looks like Kenzie might be married, and they seem so close to Linda. I should probably stop stalking them, but one comment from Linda on Kenzie's Facebook made me cry. Kenzie posted that she had completed a milestone in Peloton bike rides, and her grandma Linda commented, "That's so incredible. You go with your healthy, gorgeous Peloton self." And what actually made me sob, I read a blog post Kenzie wrote while at Texas Tech, which in part said this: "Fear is a funny thing. Everyone experiences fear differently. When I'm afraid, I try to take it all head on, and I'm not good at asking for help. Others, when faced with fear, give up. Some people may avoid whatever is causing them the fear. My grandmother is someone who can take on fear and deal with it beautifully. The one common factor between all these scenarios, however, is fear itself. We all have dealt with fear in our lives and will inevitably deal with it again. This past winter break, my family went to Washington, D.C. to visit family. While there, I got a tattoo. It is a K with angel wings for my mother, Carrie, and my sister, Cassidy, who have passed away. I have found myself looking at this tattoo every time I feel afraid, like before going into a patient's room and asking my mom to guide me and comfort me. Maybe God holds us up with his righteous right hand through those we love and walk within his life. Maybe we shouldn't be afraid because not only do we have him, we have those he has placed in our lives. Maybe fear isn't a bad thing. Maybe we can use that fear to become the best Christians we can be. And maybe fear is beautiful." I think it's safe to say that through Carrie's wonderful mother, Linda, her little girls are thriving, and Carrie and Cassidy's legacy lives on. Seven Deadly Sinners was written and created by me, Rachel O'Brien. Sound engineering and music production by Greg Hunter. And produced by Rachel O'Brien and Greg Hunter. Thank you for listening.